Regulators rushed to close Silicon Valley Bank, which was a financial institution with more than $200 billion in assets, when it experienced a traditional run on the bank as depositors rushed to withdraw all of their funds. It is the second largest bank failure in U.S. history, behind only the 2008 failure of Washington Mutual. So what went wrong here? And how did this happen? And what does this mean for the U.S. financial sector? I'm Christy Eye, and you're watching The Cost of Everything, where today we're going to be looking at the cost of bailouts and the crisis of confidence that led to the creation of Bitcoin. Bank failures happen all the time. We just don't hear about it because they are local and happen on a very small scale. But there have actually been more than 550 banks that have shut down between 2001 and 2023. And this one was particularly notable given its size and scale and the contagion effects it would have on the U.S. economy, given how it services so much of the tech and small business industry. The bank's failure came as a result of its investments losing value and depositors withdrawing large amounts of money. SVB kept a large portion of deposits in U.S. Treasury bonds and other long-term debts. These assets have low risk and low returns. But then as the Fed started to increase interest rates, SVB's bonds became riskier investments because the investors could buy bonds at higher interest rates, while SVB's bonds declined in value. SVB had to sell some of these investments at a loss of $1.8 billion in order to accommodate its customers' withdrawals. And that was the beginning of the end for SVB as withdrawals continued to mount. In an effort to shore up confidence in the U.S. banking system, the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, and the FDIC announced that Silicon Valley Bank clients would be protected and be able to access their money. They also announced steps that are intended to protect the bank's customers and prevent additional bank runs. And these actions marked the most extensive government intervention in the banking system since the 2008 financial crisis. The Biden administration announced that it would guarantee uninsured deposits. The Fed Reserve also announced a new lending program for all banks that need to borrow money to pay for withdrawals. The Fed also said that banks borrowed about $300 billion in emergency funding, with nearly half of that amount going to holding up companies for the two failed banks to pay depositors. The Fed did not say how many other banks borrowed money and added that it expects the loans to be repaid. Meanwhile, Biden has insisted that no taxpayer money will be used to resolve the crisis, and the White House is very desperate to avoid any perception that the average Americans are quote-unquote bailing out the banks like what happened during the 2008 financial crisis. Instead, the money will come from the FDIC, with the funds coming from the quarterly premiums that the insured banks pay to the agency. The FDIC estimated that the cost of SVB's failure would be about $20 billion. But even if taxpayers aren't directly on the hook, the bank's customers still stand to benefit from the government support. Saying that the taxpayer won't pay anything ignores the fact that providing insurance to someone who didn't pay for insurance is actually a gift. On top of that, while the taxpayer may not be paying for the losses directly, there will ultimately be a trickle-down. Following this, banks will likely have to pay more for deposit insurance and then charge the taxpayer a higher interest rate on loans or pay out a lower percentage of interest into its savings accounts. So while the efforts of the central government has seemed to stop the domino cascade of banks for now, there are many who believe that this isn't over yet. What appears to be happening is that the fractional reserve banking system is under stress due to rising interest rates and is showing its cracks. And it's not just SVB. SVB failed due to an old-fashioned bank run that was spurred on by the weakness on its balance sheet because of poor duration risk management. Silvergate was running into some issues and had to take out an FHLB loan, but its eventual winding down was reported voluntary. And as for Signature Bank, the regulators can't even figure out if the bank was shut down because of crypto or because of a crisis in confidence of leadership. 11 banks also injected $30 billion into First Republic Bank in order to save it. And outside of the US, Credit Suisse also went kaput due to years of mismanagement and significant write-downs in investments. So now let's bring in Chris Rice, host of Rice TV. So Chris, how are the bank failures this time around different from the bank failures we saw in 2008?
Okay, that's a great question. Thanks again for having me back on the program. The difference this time would really be what happened in 2007 and 2008 was actually the death of the system. Unfortunately, at the time, what they did to keep everything going was to put everything on life support, and the banking institutions were basically zombies. What we had seen since the 2008 crash was early 2020, if anybody's listening recalls to March of 2020, the markets got hit really big, especially because we had this black swan event that we ended up having to consider locking down when we had the pandemic and stuff that took place. That time period in March of 2020, they actually halted the stock market just like they did in 2008. Had they not halted the trading both occasions, the system would have crashed. And they aren't ready for the system to crash. And they're even not completely ready for the system to crash yet. They're waiting for the actual development for the central bank digital currency so they can usher in a new system. They need a new system to replace the system that's crashing and falling apart.
And of the four banking failures so far, we got Signature, SVB, Credit Suisse, and First Republic. Which one would have been the most disastrous if it had not been bailed out? Could the economy afford not to bail them out?
The free market would have corrected itself. Capitalism would have came about. Actually, we would have been in a lot better position if we would have just dealt with the crash at the time. But again, the systems that be didn't have an alternate system for us to replace the antiquated system that was crashing. When you study fiat currencies and you study how the cycles of fiat currencies work, all fiat currencies end up going back to their intrinsic value, which is zero. And it's happened throughout history. There's never been a point of history where this has not taken place. And if you look at the Roman Empire and what took place of the fall of the Roman Empire, that is very much comparable as to what we are seeing in today's modern day United States of America.
We see the bigger banks stepping in to shore up the smaller banks and prevent further knock-on effects. But do the bigger banks have a healthy enough balance sheet to continue this and bail out the smaller, weaker banks?
The contagion effect and how many people have investments, people's like their retirement, people's different Wall Street investments. I mean, they're tied into a lot of people's lives. So I understand why they're trying to keep these banks afloat and keep them active. But the one thing that we've got to take in consideration is prior to 2020, there was a 10% reserve requirement that the banks were required to have on hand at all times, which meant they had to have 10% of their funds at on hand. Since 2020, that reserve requirement has been taken away, and banks aren't required to have any reserve requirement at all anymore. So I've even told people now with the way banking is, we really need to look at banking as how we would look at it as an investment. Don't deposit more than you're willing to lose. Because the other thing I would have mentioned with the difference between 2008 and where we are today is bail-ins versus bailouts, because we had bailouts taking place then. And since then, there's been legislation and laws passed in the United States that allows for bail-ins, which affects the customers of the banks. They will be the ones who will be losing their funds. And this is just beginning, obviously. I think everybody's in agreement that the cracks are just starting to get deeper, and it's going to get worse before it even gets better as far as these bank collapses. But it is all done by design because we have the ushering in of Fed Now coming, which is supposed to be taking place in June or July. And I believe July is the specific date they're pushing for, but it wouldn't surprise me if it comes out sooner. And FedNow is an instant payment service, 24/7, 365, is some sort of alternative to blockchain technology that's completely centralized and controlled by the Federal Reserve.
Could SVB's failure been prevented? Did anyone foresee this happening?
Absolutely. The interesting thing with the Signature Bank in particular is you had Barney Frank, who from the Dodd-Frank Act, as one of the advisors on the board of directors for Signature Bank. He has come out saying that there was absolutely no reason for Signature Bank to be shuttered. But if you actually do a little bit of digging and researching, you will see that Signature was under investigation for money laundering by the Department of Justice as well as the SEC. So there's been some things that were taking place on the back end prior to the actual Federal Reserve and Treasury stepping in to shutter the bank. But again, the commonality that you had between Silvergate initially, which took place several weeks, maybe a month or so before SVB, the Silicon Valley Bank situation, then followed up by Signature. Those three banks, the one thing that they all have in common is they were all crypto friendly, and they were the most friendly bank. So it was obviously a very direct attack on cryptocurrency. And we are seeing that coming from the United States government, especially under the Biden administration, from the SEC all the way to the Federal Reserve, to your chairhead, Ms. Janet Yellen. They are all right now conspiring to try to make crypto inaccessible to the general public so they can usher in their big brother surveillance coin that they're calling central bank digital currency.
Are these banks truly too big to fail? Because they're not as big as JP Morgan Chase or Citibank. So why were they not allowed to fail? And what would the ramifications have been?
Well, the saying is too big to fail banks, but it's not too big to fail. It's too big to allow to fail. So what the Federal Reserve and the Treasury has come out already saying as far as their backstops is when they're having bank failures, if these particular banks don't cause contagion to the rest of the system, they're going to allow for the failure to take place. So in videos that I've covered on my channel, Rice TVX, I've come up to the equation. This is all problem, reaction, solution, consolidation. They want to get it consolidated down to the few that are in the club, the central bank, digital currency, the financial institutions, the traditional financial institutions like your JP Morgans, your Bank of America. Again, some people think that these institutions are too big to fail. They're just too big to allow to fail. That is the difference between something like a Silicon Valley Bank versus a JP Morgan. Also, I mean, I'm sure we'll bring this up, those bank collapses also had a lot to do with taking away entry and exit points for people regarding cryptocurrency.
Thank you so much, Chris, but please stick around. Chris Rice will be joining us right after the break. And when we come back, is Bitcoin a more secure alternative to traditional banking system? And the answer? We'll have that for you after the break.
In the case of China, it's the U.S. further elevated Taiwan's international status. You see, you have Nancy Pelosi's visit, which already create crisis. If you have Anthony Blinken, I'm sure China will start a military operation. I don't have even doubt about that.
The problem is the cost of housing keeps on going up. Cost of living keeps on going up. Inflation keeps on going up. Yes. Gas keeps on going up. So all the cost of living keeps on rising.
I had a voucher over the summer, and I still wasn't able to find housing because there's no affordable housing in Lakewood.
I've seen an increase in people calling me, asking me for a place to stay. Need to get tent.
Yeah, we've had people that have been millionaires in the past, you know, had big businesses. Different things can throw you over the edge. Yeah, you know, so people shouldn't be so judgmental about the homeless because it can happen. It can happen to almost anybody.
I think the government needs to help all these homeless people.
Yeah, I know.
Instead of sending money over to Ukraine and all those other countries, worry about your own country. I just wish we had a president that cared. But we don't have a president that cares. I wish people would wake up and see what Joe Biden is doing to us.
People don't realize in the deep that America is in. What is this kind of immorality happening in our nation? And people taking back like, oh, it's okay.
Welcome back to The Cost of Everything. Bitcoin's price has soared since news broke of the bank's failures, reaching $30,000, which is up 70% for the year. And this is no surprise for those in the space, as given Bitcoin's history and birth in 2009 as an alternative to traditional big banking. The traditional banking model still suffers from the inherent weaknesses of the trust-based model. And now we have an environment where higher interest rates after a period of hyper-low interest rates are creating bank runs. And this is the most perfect Bitcoin use case scenario, where we see Bitcoin being a more secure alternative to traditional banking systems, which are vulnerable to the problems faced by SVB. According to a report from economists using SVB as a proxy, more than 186 banks are prone to collapse. Per the report, SVB had a higher capitalization of more than 10% of existing banks, and that 10% of U.S. banks have more unrecognized losses than SVB. So it's not a stretch to imagine that we have not seen the other shoe drop yet, and the banking crisis may intensify over the coming months. In sight of this dismal backdrop and the sell-off in global equities, the crypto market has risen against all odds. Bitcoin has retained its status among many as being an asset more removed from the banking system than traditional stocks and government bonds. When the banking system breaks down, the flight to safety is in Bitcoin. Bitcoin is insulated from the type of bank runs that many feared would happen if the federal government hadn't rushed in to assure all clients of SVB that they would get their money back. People are now recognizing the importance of sound money with no counterparty risk. And many believe that this rally is not because of fear triggered by the crisis itself, but rather the aggressive response from the government and the Federal Reserve that has seen hundreds of billions of dollars added to or pledged to the banking system and dramatically shifting the outlook for interest rates. On top of that, the collapse of SVB and Silvergate was like a Cyprus moment for crypto. As these crypto-friendly banks collapsed, a lot of money flowed directly into the cryptocurrency ecosystem. The crypto market also tends to perform better when the traditional financial markets experience turbulence, reflecting the transparency and decentralization of the DeFi world. And for more, let's bring in again Chris Rice, host of Rice TVX. Now, we saw USDC depeg for a couple days, dropping all the way down to 87 cents. So what does this tell us about the stablecoin, and is it really all that stable?
Yes, it is. And I'm not actually a huge fan of stablecoins. Stablecoins and CBDCs, there's not much of a difference. They're both programmable currencies. The only difference would be there may be some sort of legislation or some sort of process the government may have to go through from the in order to get the records of the information from the stablecoin companies. But both USDC and USDT have worked with the United States government, the Department of Justice. They have all cooperated, and they've all frozen accounts of people because these stablecoins are designed to be programmable, and they can, in a sense, do the same thing they would do with the central bank digital currency. Now, in the case of USDC, what happened was there was a portion of their money that was backing up the collateral that makes up what USDC is backed by. It's fully regulated. Circle Invest is the company behind it. JP Morgan is the company behind Circle Invest. They're very much compliant. It's very much backed one for one. But a portion of their deposits were in SVB Bank. And once people had realized that, they were questioning how much exposure they had to SVB Bank. And it was only like something like 3.5% of the total backing of USDC. So I think the markets overreacted to that situation a little bit more so than they needed to. And in the case of USDT, it's also fully backed by, if not dollars, it's also backed by treasury bonds. And both companies, Tether and USDC Circle, are very transparent about what backs up their tokens. At this point, if USDT wasn't being compliant on a regulatory standpoint, they would be obliterated and destroyed. But they are compliant. They've corrected a lot of their situations that were questionable back in the past. And again, they are very much working with the government. I've made videos talking about instances where the FBI and the Department of Justice have worked both with USDT and USDC. So it's just two birds of the same coin when it comes to CBDCs and stablecoins, because really, in all actually, a lot of people think that the digital dollar will be USDC.
Ever since the banks faltered, crypto seemed to be getting a second wind as sentiment turned bullish. And to me, this is like a flight to safety, just like in 2008 when people distrusted banks and would rather bank themselves. So what do you make of this, and how is that going to go when they're getting rid of all of the Bitcoin onboarding ramps?
A big part of it also that you didn't include the equation is BlackRock and Infel. I'm drawing a blank on the company's name. I'm not sure. It's a big financial institution that's just recently started offering cryptocurrency services. It'll come to me in just a moment. But we have a big there's people within the financial system that also recognize Bitcoin and what Bitcoin has to offer. So I think it's a combination of things that people are looking at different ways of preserving their wealth, their assets, because the way that the fiat system is designed, people are losing purchasing power. So in order to not lose purchasing power, people diversify and they figure out different ways they can hedge against the dollar. And Bitcoin is definitely one of those things. I mean, that's what it was created for, was to be a hedge against the dollar. So it is what Bitcoin was specific, and I use Bitcoin specifically. What Bitcoin was created for is the time period that we are currently in right now. So now we get to see how Bitcoin is going to perform in the environment that it was designed to perform in, if that makes sense.
The U.S. is now cracking down on crypto, citing it as a reason for the instability we see in the financial sector. So what do you think is their end goal? And do they just want to see all crypto leave U.S. shores? Or do you think it's more about control and them trying to regulate and do some sort of CBDC, like what they criticized China for doing?
That's a really good question. And I'm not really sure that they necessarily want crypto to just leave U.S. shores, but they definitely want to have control at the same time. So if that means getting rid of the obstacle, which may mean trying to eliminate something like Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, that is a possibility. I mean, we definitely see it on the plate. In the United States specifically, when it comes to legislation, I'm not even talking on a federal level, just talking on a state level. You have something called the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC law. And the laws try to make the laws the same in all these states in the United States to help create trade and commerce to be easier, because that way there's no restrictions based off differences of laws and legislation. And one of the things that they're trying to pass through as an amendment right now on state levels in like a 120 something page document, and only a portion of that document covers the aspect that I'm warning people about, which also Governor DeSantis has recently warned people. He did an anti-CBDC bill in Florida, and we also had South Dakota Governor Noem, who also vetoed the same bill. And what the UCC amendment is trying to do is redefine money to exclude Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, but to include central bank digital currencies. And this would affect commerce. The UCC makes things uniform. So in a sense, once these things are passed on state levels, you wouldn't be able to use these cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, for example, and the other cryptocurrencies as a sort of money, because the Uniform Commercial Code is taking it out of a definition of so. So they're trying to attack crypto on a state level, on a federal level, and they're trying to sneak the state stuff in like they normally do with legislation. And people are waking up to it. And now you have governors. When I called a central bank digital currency a big brother surveillance coin, I'm just quoting Ron DeSantis.
But even if the government don't recognize Bitcoin and cryptocurrency as money, does it really matter if the seller is still willing to accept Bitcoin for payment? I mean, that's what bartering and peer-to-peer payment is. As long as the counterparty is willing to accept it as compensation, then it really doesn't matter if the authority recognizes it as money or not, right?
It wouldn't ban Bitcoin. You're right. It wouldn't. But it would make it difficult for people to use Bitcoin in a commerce situation. Like, I wouldn't be able to buy my groceries from Walmart or something like that because of the way the law would be defined. But yes, I could go and do a direct peer-to-peer connection. They couldn't ban Bitcoin and they can't outright destroy crypto, but they can make it difficult to on-ramp, off-ramp, and use.
Thank you so much, Chris Rice, for joining us today. And if we look at the history of Bitcoin and why it was created in the first place, It was precisely for events like we see today, where the current system shows sign of weaknesses. Its decentralized system and peer-to-peer technology gives Bitcoin the potential to dismantle the entire banking system in which a central authority is responsible for decisions that affect the economies of entire countries. If people embrace this new technology, then the banks have much to lose. Banks would lose control of monetary policies and therefore control of the population. Bitcoin enables the citizens of a country to undermine government authority by circumventing capital controls imposed by it. It was invented to address the devaluation of fiat currency through reckless spending and borrowing. And fiat currency is not backed by tangible assets anymore. And by manipulating the supply of money in the US economy, the central bank also manufactures asset bubbles and crises. And only time will tell how long these fiat regimes will last and who will be the last one standing. I'm Christy Yai. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you right back here next time on The Cost of Everything.